Thank you. This is KPFT, Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, your community-sponsored radio station. Bob Gartner is on engineering, and I always appreciate his work. And it's going to be open forum, so you can call and chat about whatever is on your mind or anything I say that provokes something to be on your mind or something you've been cogitating on all week and have just been waiting for this show to talk about. The phone number is 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. Because of the little bumper about the fundraiser just before the show started, actually, there are two things I'll say. First of all, kpft.org, tip jar, tell them Think Wing Radio sent you, contribute whatever you can, because we're always hard up for money, and we can't do this for free, even with all the volunteers we have. That's the first thing. Second thing, talking about the Olympic theme, this is really a fascinating story that many of you don't know about. The theme that is generally considered the Olympic theme, that one was actually from when ABC did the Olympics for many, many years. CBS did it a little, but ABC did it for so many years that that became, in the cultural mind, the Olympic theme. And then I think it was for the Los Angeles Olympics was the first time that NBC carried it. And, you know, they didn't want to license the ABC theme. They can't use it for free, but it's what everybody identifies with the Olympics, but they didn't want to use it and pay the theme. So they went to John Williams, and John Williams came up with this grand march, Olympic march for NBC. It's the one that they finished that little bit. So they start with the ABC theme, but then they finish up with the John Williams NBC theme. And people just, you know, they never loved it. So NBC was forced to fall back on that ABC licensed Olympics theme more often than they would like. Another little bit of trivia is a lot of the what they call interstitial music, the music between like events and whatnot, was actually the music written for a Bruce Campbell series, which all of a sudden now slips my mind. The Adventures of, and Bob is shaking his head. The Adventures of something, Briscoe County, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. And they use that theme for the Olympics all the time. So I'm always thinking of Bruce Campbell on a horse doing the Lone Ranger thing with the horse rearing up on two legs. All right, enough of that stuff. 713-526-5738. All right, let's start slow. I like to start a little light and then maybe get into heavier stuff. First of all, the first full total solar eclipse over North America since 1979 is going to be coming a year from now. In August of 2017, we will have a total eclipse of the sun over North America. I remember the one from 79, and I have to tell you, if you're not expecting it and you don't know what it is, I can understand why ancient peoples found that extremely scary. it gets really dark. It's amazing. So just thought I'd mention that. Okay, the next thing, for those of you who care, BBC has sold the music rights to Doctor Who's theme, along with a lot of the cue music that goes on during the show. So now you might hear Doctor Who music. And for any of you who watch Doctor Who, the music is extremely evocative. I mean, you know that this is Doctor Who music. It's very striking. So it could now pop up in advertising campaigns and sports events and video games and other things. So the BBC story, actually it's a DoctorWhoWatch.com story. They point out there's nothing to worry about in regards to the future of the theme music on Doctor Who, but be certain that the show is actually on before rushing back from the kitchen and potentially spilling our beer and snacks. Okay, so going on, apparently bagpipers in Scotland are terrified after scientists claim that bacteria in bagpipes can kill. Essentially, there's a potentially deadly bacteria lurking in bagpipes, and one bagpiper has already died from it, and it has to do with the moist interiors of the pipes, which are thought to foster the growth of fungi and molds. In other words, when you hear those wonderful Scottish bagpipes, just don't examine them too closely with, like, a laparoscope or something. So you must clean your bagpipes, folks. You've got to keep your bagpipes clean. Okay, next. One in three U.S. voters think that voter fraud is a major problem, but Republicans were more likely than Democrats to view voter fraud as a major problem. 52% of Republicans versus 26% of Democrats. I'm kind of embarrassed that 26% of Democrats think that voter fraud is a problem. I think that they're confusing voter fraud with election fraud. Election fraud is a problem. Voter fraud, virtually none. It's like parts per billion you practically have to go to. So I just thought that was interesting. We still have open lines, and I've got a couple of callers waiting. I'll get to them shortly. 713-526-5738. Apparently, you may know that Aetna has quit Obamacare in a lot of the different markets. And apparently, this was a tit-for-tat because the Justice Department was interfering with their merger with Humana. And apparently there is a letter, what they're calling a smoking gun in the headline of the LA Times article, that if the DOJ persisted in this, in blocking this merger, well, then they might withdraw from these markets. After saying previously that, oh, no, we won't withdraw from them because we actually find them to be pretty good markets. So this is extortion. This is corporate extortion. Another reason to have single payer. Let's see. You may have heard that Russia was doing some bombing in Syria, that they were flying out of an Iranian airbase. Apparently, that was something they were supposed to keep to themselves. Iran said that the Russian warplanes now had stopped using the Iranian air. This is from the Financial Times. Had stopped using an Iranian airbase a day after the Islamic regime accused Moscow of showing off by making public its use of the facility. So, loose lips, sink air bases. You can go to my website, thinkwingradio.com. I've got links to basically every article I cite, so you can go to the original articles and think about them what you will. In Iraq, there was a would-be child bomber, a 15-year-old, who was working for ISIS. The Iraqi security people were able to apprehend him before he set off the bomb. Of course, there was a child bomber at a wedding in Turkey, a Kurdish wedding in Turkey, that killed at least 54 people, almost half of which were children under 14. Interesting article in Vice, What I Learned as a Black Man Traveling Through the Terrifying Heart of America. Interesting story. Not as downbeat as the title would imply, but there's a little of that. Okay, let's take a break, and I will take some phone calls. 713-526-5738. First up is Jerry. How you doing tonight, Jerry?
I'm all right. Yeah, I was going to say election fraud's a much bigger problem. Of course, that's what Republicans like to engage in, so they're less worried about it.
I'm not going to say just Republicans, but I think that it's often, more often Republicans than Democrats. And of course, human error does happen as well. And that's not technically election fraud, but it's significant election error, what they call undercounts. So,
yeah.
But deliberate manipulation of the vote, election fraud, that's a bigger problem than voter fraud.
Yeah. And there are, in fact, people in prison on that one. And all that.
Not enough.
No, not enough, no doubt. But and all that. And, of course, there's been a monkey wrench put into a lot of people's plans to suppress the vote. But in so many states, there's, including Texas, they've kind of like had a, encountered some issues and all that.
Well, there have been some recent district court, federal district court rulings that are putting monkey wrenches in some of those discriminatory voter rules, but not enough, not soon enough, too close to the election. We really needed to have decisions on this much sooner, and we really needed to smack it down much more effectively. But of course, Republican Congress. So this is actually a good excuse for me to mention that Election Day, November 8th, is closing in. You must be registered to vote by October 8th. You can go to either harrisvotes.com or you can go to votetexas.gov, find out if you're registered, if you're registered properly, and how to register if you need to. So doing my thing there. So go ahead. So you're talking about voter fraud, election fraud, anything else?
You know, yeah, I heard about that thing about the Russians flying out of there.
That was a shock.
Out of Iran. Well, you know, they, you know, all those guys are in bed with Assad. And, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know that, I won't say that American policy on Syria has been really the most brilliant. But
I don't know that there is a brilliant policy on Syria.
No, it's a complicated situation and everything. But you know, one of the things that they had, actually, I saw Seymour Hersh on C-SPAN for a few minutes and afterwards, and he said, he was, they were talking about the killing of Osama bin Laden, his book, and everything. It's very complicated over there, and that's what people don't realize, is just how complicated it is. You know, one of the problems that they had was when they sat there and said that Assad used chemical weapons, actually a couple of groups, particularly al-Nusra Front, had access to chemical weapons like that.
And now they're saying ISIS is using mustard gas.
Well, it may very well be. But, you know, that's something that, you know, once again, people complain about drone strikes and all that. And I don't understand what some of the arguments are. I don't totally disagree with them. But, you know, those drone strikes keep everybody thinking twice about, like, trying to use that kind of stuff on us.
You know, the thing about drone strikes, and I think this is really interesting, I think that on some level, the objection to drone strikes, I mean, you can go into whether, you know, we should be using them in different countries on different borders, but I don't think that's even the strongest objection to drone strikes. I think it's the very principle of drone strikes that gets a lot of people worked up. And I think that maybe one of the reasons is it seems in a way unfair. You know, it's almost like, well, it's assassination in many cases. And assassination is equated in one sense or another with murder, depending on which side you're on. And I think that it's something about not having a human being at risk in the execution of, let's call it a wartime killing of another individual. It's inhuman. And yet, you know, is artillery fair? You know, someone shoots a bullet at you from 10 miles away and it lands on you faster than the speed of sound, so the bomb goes off before you can hear it whistling through the air. And somehow that has gotten into the point of, yeah, everybody expects artillery, but is that any more fair than a drone?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
And no, I don't think so. And in fact, what's going to happen is finally, you know, drones are going to get more and more sophisticated, and you're going to get to a point where it's harder and harder. They're going to figure out ways fix things so that, you know, you don't know for sure whether it was a drone strike or not.
You know that
that's
the Navy
wind up doing.
The Navy has actually been experimenting with essentially a full-sized aircraft that can be carrier-launched that looks just like a regular fighter aircraft or fighter bomber, which, and I guess without the pilot, you can put a lot more ordnance in it. You can lighten some of the armor, perhaps, in it to protect the pilot. So, I mean, there's, and obviously you just don't lose a multi-million dollar value trained pilot in the process. I mean, this, you know, it's not Terminator level stuff. It's not Skynet, but there's something creepy about robots killing humans.
Well, I was going to say, you're going to see more and more robots out in the battlefield too, as we go along here and all that. You know, I don't think, you know, that's just technological advancement. I don't think there's any way to really stop that. And you know, I don't think that that's very realistic in terms of, you know, plus, you know, I hate to say it. Everybody sits there and goes, well, I wouldn't drone strike, you know, whoever or whatever. You don't know that. You don't know what kind of intelligence Obama's looking at there in the White House. And all that. Everybody sits there and gets up on their high horse, but when you're in that spot and all that, and you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't, you decide that, you know, you're going to have to be damned if you do.
Well, I think one thing we can learn from history, World War II being the most recent example, is that assuming no external constraints, war will escalate to what is called total war, where essentially nothing is off limits, everything is possible, and anything you can do to gain advantage will be done. The only reason I think that wars like Korea did not escalate to that level is because you had the constraints of China and the Soviet Union. And there were those, including Douglas MacArthur, who wanted to move the Korean War into China. I mean, that was the big deal about the Yalu River. That's the border between North Korea and China. He wanted to advance beyond the Yalu, which is when the Chinese actually entered the war with manpower. And in response to that, Douglas MacArthur said, well, we can nuke them. And Truman just went, I don't think so. Maybe you should resign.
Yeah.
But, I mean, all of that is, like, really, really interesting. So when we talk about drone strikes, you know, you're talking about, you have capabilities, you try to weigh the capabilities against whatever the external or maybe perhaps even moral constraints or legal constraints might be. You kind of weigh them, but war has a way of escalating because everybody wants to use the advantage they've got. It's just the nature of war. It's one of the reasons it's to be avoided. It is unpredictable.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, and that's a good point. But, you know, you're not always sure to win or whatever every time or whatever, every battle or whatever.
Everybody who starts a war thinks they're going to win. I mean, that's just kind of the nature of, you know, starting a war.
Yeah, and, you know, basically, you know, sometimes wars, of course, start by accident, World War One being sort of an example
Biggest family feud in human history.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that basically the period of total war basically runs from about the 1850s through the end of World War Two, basically. And what ended total war pretty much was the arrival of atomic weapons and the Cold War itself, the nature. Like I said, the political nature, there was some technological issues there, once again, the bomb. But there was some political changes there, too.
Whoever got that bomb first would have used it. Let's not pretend anything different.
If the Japanese,
I know that. I'm just saying, for people who think, you know, we were too horrible for using the bomb, you can have your opinions on that. But just know, the Japanese were working on an atomic bomb. If they'd gotten it first, they would have used it. The Nazis were working on an atomic bomb. If they'd gotten it first, they would have used it.
That's true.
So we got it first. We were smart enough or lucky enough or had enough immigrant Jewish scientists from Nazi Germany that we were able to get it first. Jerry, I have a couple of other folks on the line.
Oh, yeah, let me let you go. I'll talk to you later.
I appreciate your calling very much, as always. Thank you. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. Bob Gartner is on engineering as usual. And do remember, you can go to kpft.org, go to the tip jar, and you can help support KPFT, which is, while run mostly by volunteers, still actually needs money. We fell $40,000 short in the last drive, so we're going to be coming up on another short drive soon, the back-to-school drive. But you can help to keep that short if you can find it in your heart and your wallet To contribute a few bucks to kpft.org, go to the tip jar, maybe say Think Wing Radio sent you, contribute whatever you can, anything from a couple of bucks to $1,000 or whatever. You know, boy, we could sure use like a $20 million endowment, but I'm not saying that's necessary. It can be a lot less. Okay, before I move on, I got my first actual physical fan letter. I mean, I get email from listeners occasionally, which I always enjoy and find flattering, usually. This is from Gabriel, and he lives in Livingston, Texas. I tend to follow the South China Sea and East China Sea situation, and Gabriel felt that there were some things that he wanted to point out, and essentially I think that the essence of his letter is that there's a lot of ethnicity involved in the South China Sea. You know, if you've ever spoken to someone who is British, you can call a Scot British or a Northern Irish or a Welsh British, but if you start to call them English, they will stop you. I'm not English. I'm Scottish. I'm not English. I'm Irish. I'm Welsh. And it's very much like that in Asia and, of course, other parts of the world. So, you know, if you see someone who looks, quote unquote, Chinese or Oriental, they might be Korean or Japanese or Chinese or Vietnamese or Lao or Thai or even in some cases Philippine. And they are very particular about their ethnicity. You know, so if you call a Vietnamese person Chinese, they will probably correct you. Or, you know, if they're polite, they'll just roll their eyes maybe a little. And he was pointing out, Gabriel was, how important all of this is in the South China Sea area, that a lot of these countries have so much ethnic pride that it's easier for them to ally with a non-Asian power like the United States than with, say, Vietnam and the Philippines, because they've got their stuff. So it's like the United States, as an example, may become, in a sense, the hub of a web of alliances where the countries are not so much allied with each other as they're aligned with the United States, who is aligned with the other countries, and therefore... Anyway, it was an interesting letter. I enjoyed it. It was thought-provoking. So thank you, Gabriel, for that. That's Gabriel in Livingston, Texas. I appreciate your letter. I will respond because you don't have an email on there, so I actually have to write something and mail it, but I will do that. Okay, next up is Mark. Mark, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting. How you been?
I'm doing great. The guest that was on the monitor talking about the Clinton Foundation, I found very interesting.
Okay, you'll have to bring me up to speed on that because I was not listening.
Well, it's basically donations coming from people from other countries, not necessarily within the United States, giving to the Clinton Foundation. And he outlined one main donor of the Clinton Foundation. It's kind of, he's in Canada, so they don't have to disclose where they get the money from. So it's like a bundling operation. He gets all the donors, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, whatever. They give him the money, then he lumps them into the Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, bundlers are a pretty common phenomenon in politics.
Right, it's all political.
Sure.
My upcoming point is, I don't think Trump is going to win the election. I think Hillary will, but this whole, there's going to be more of this coming out about the Clinton Foundation, and basically, you know, it's just a political organization. It's not really a charity.
Well, no, it actually is a charity, and it actually, from what I have read,
right,
scores really
right
well in terms of the donations it makes versus the so-called administrative expenses that it charges.
Well, it actually doesn't. There's one of the, the guy that was on the monitor was talking about one of these organizations that rates charitable organizations. They can't even rate it because they don't get enough data. But my point is, she'll win the election, but this will be another thing. She won't, the House won't go, the Senate might go, but this will be something that will create political gridlock for the 4 years that she's president.
You know, of course, that the Republicans don't need an excuse for gridlock. They merely find one.
Right, right. And this is just one more thing. If this wasn't going on, it wouldn't matter.
No, there'd be gridlock for something else.
Right.
Benghazi.
So she's going to be the most ineffective president probably ever. she might get a few Supreme Court justices through. But in a time when we're looking at climate change, we're looking at wars all over the world. When's it time to declare that we're in World War III?
Yeah.
We're going to get a very weak president, not really a leader that can do anything. So this foundation thing and the emails is just one more very bad situation.
It's just a smokescreen. It's a smokescreen.
I'm leaving. Bye. I've done my thing.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mark. I'm sorry if you feel like I might have talked over you.
That's fine.
All right. Take care. I disagree with Mark. I actually think that if Hillary wins the election and if the Democrats capture, actually, I don't have Bob to cut off the line, so I don't know if Mark is still actually there or not, or maybe his line hasn't disconnected yet. I don't think Hillary would be a weak president. I think there's a very good chance the Democrats will capture the Senate. I think there's some possibility that the Democrats will capture the House. Okay, so now I need Bob back. I don't think I know how to do this. Let's see. Ah, I guess I do know how to do this. I think I put him on hold, but at least, you know, that's better than nothing. I actually think that Hillary could end up being a fairly strong president. I think that she will be more assertive than Obama. She's at least as smart as Obama. She comes to the job with much more experience and knowledge, either as First Lady or as Senator or as Secretary of State, than Obama did when he became president. I think she's accustomed to withstanding withering attacks from adversaries. I think that it will be very interesting and perhaps surprising how effective she might be. And you know what? Being able to appoint two or three Supreme Court justices, if she accomplishes nothing else and gets them through a Democratic Senate, that will be her legacy for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So I don't think she'll be a weak president or an ineffective president. I think she'll have challenges, of course, but I think that she'll probably be more combative than Obama in ways perhaps that are not going to be visible publicly, but I think she'll actually be surprisingly effective. Okay, we have open lines. We have a phone number you can call, 713-526-5738. Hey, Bob, do we have a booster signal that reaches College Station? I'm noticing in Huntsville it's 91.9. Does that signal get to College Station, do you think?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, just asking. I guess that's something I may want to ask Dwayne or Bobby or somebody.
Well, I think there's been a question posed recently regarding those types of things.
To whom? Who would that be a Dwayne question?
I probably can't elaborate on it right now.
Okay, fair enough. All right, open line, 713-526-5738. And next up, and thank you for your patience, is Kevin. Bob? Could we get Kevin, please? Thank you so much. Kevin, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Evening, Mike. I'll jump in, jump out. I like to talk about, you know, pretty much what y'all are talking about, so I'll just put my comments in there and see how you feel about it.
Okay.
So in past, you know, references to the stability of the markets and such, I gave a little, you know, overview on how that works with the current market conditions and such.
Are you talking about financial markets generally?
Yeah, I gave you a little overview on how the markets are sort of manipulated. What I want to try to do is, you know, share facts, not opinions, with you and your guests. So, you know, they can choose your opinions, but you can't choose your facts. So I know it seems a little crude sometimes.
I agree.
It's over the top for some folks to, you know, put the blinders up and go la la la, but that's expected too, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate, but yeah.
So what we'll do is we won't change. We'll just continue to provide facts,
right.
And then, you know, the ones that are, you know, interesting enough to look for themselves, I think they'll pick it up. To that much of the last, you know, inquiry about, you know, an interpretation of what the Bolshevism was.
Oh, okay.
I'll conclude with on these last two. Provide some facts. Okay. State Department dismal file. And if you want to write this down, it's a file number that was filed. It's 861.00 Ford WAC 5339.
I'm sorry, 861.00
Ford WAC slash.
What is what? I don't know what that means.
It's like, you know, instead of an F slash, a forward slash.
Okay.
5339.
And what is that State Department document?
It was filed in November 13th, 1918, and it shows Cove and Loan, a firm of Jacob Scheff and Max Wahlberg Felix, finance and contribute to the creation of the Bolshevism revolution. It's a State Department document.
State Department, okay.
Yeah, and there's several other officials like Benjamin Friedman, who was part of your Progressive Democratic Forum that was started when Jacob left the White House, very upset that the president was not going to go for it. So that's when they created it's called the Democratic Progressive Headquarters in New York, and Benjamin Friedman was assigned as chief front office. Anyway, he's wrote several books about this, so I won't take up much more of your time, but I think that State Department file, if you look it up for yourself, it might help at least you understand what I was referring to in the last call.
I will try to look it up and at least scan through it. Depends on how technical and long it is, of course.
It's pretty short.
Okay.
So I'm not going to spend much, but this is, you know, I would say, again, you know, this is taught in other academics, maybe not in your city or your state schools, but definitely in your Ivy, Yale and
political science. I guess you're talking about political science departments.
True. Yeah, and that's what. But I won't spend too much more time on that. But I listen to the shows on that KPFT have, and like Voices at Work, Progressive Forum, Air Voices, The Monitor, or Democracy Now. And I know you listen to some of them, but like even Democracy Now today or The Monitor, the guy that Mark, he's right. Private Clearinghouse won't touch the foundation.
I'm sorry, you're starting to break up.
The Clinton Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Price Clearinghouse water won't.
Price Waterhouse.
They won't audit the Clinton Foundation. The guy who wrote the book said that they are such a large organization that they can control the world and meet world leaders.
So now we have a category of too big to audit?
Yes, and this is from your guest that was on the monitor earlier, and the very astute on the research, he's put another book out, but the information, half the stuff I share is actually from your other shows with the guest, so it blows you away.
I get the Reader's Digest version of KPFT's lineup from you. That's interesting.
Yeah, this is a lot. Listen to all shows, man. And these are, you know, I think a good source, Associated Press or journalists themselves. So anyway, that so bad that Clinton has left, quit the Clinton Foundation, and Chelsea has stopped taking donations. So they're going to lockdown now.
I think that's appropriate that if Hillary is elected, or even at this point looks more or less certain to be elected, then, you know, they're going to have to do some adjustments in order to avoid the impression of a conflict of interest, you know,
right,
where people are trying to obtain influence through donations to a third party, i.e. the Clinton Foundation, which might then turn into what at least looks like a quid pro quo from a Hillary administration.
Right. So with that said, her former campaign director has also resigned 2 weeks ago when it was found out a $35 million deal with Russia was made. So her former campaign director has resigned. The bill goes around and caters all the world leaders, and they donate to the Clinton Foundation. What's funny is, if you even mention Trump, he is such a cheapskate. He is so chintzy that he doesn't really have a comparable foundation. It's not really worth mentioning.
No. He has a foundation, but I don't think they can document much money going anywhere that wasn't a Trump-connected entity.
Well, you know, for Trump, you know, for him to get started in the casinos, right there, that means he's in business with his folks. And Allison, you know, doesn't really care much for him, but Trump is setting up to him. He's the largest Vegas mafia campaign donator right now. But I'll try to wrap up with where can I finish? For history, regarding, I don't know if you know about Prince Edward. He was after Prince Albert.
Prince Edward is the one who resigned?
No, he was the guy that was replaced his dad, Prince Albert, in the late 19th century. He basically, from 1865 on up, he ran London when Victoria went north to Scotland, his mom, and he basically spent years writing up the framework for the following two world wars.
Yeah, Kevin, we're going to have to wrap this up because really your signal is breaking up pretty badly.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you again. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All right. We have open lines, 713-526-5738. I actually think there's a lot of stuff to talk about here. Elon Musk, he bought a company called SolarCity, and what he wants to do, and it's the quote from the article in Popular Mechanics, is there's no indication when these solar shingles will hit the market, and there are no specifics yet when it comes to price or other details. However, Musk says that when the solar roof does launch, people are going to be really excited about what they see. Here's the story. Elon Musk feels that solar panels, installing them on a roof, there are certain inherent problems. One of the problems is that, of course, the roof has a lifespan that might actually be different from the lifespan of the solar panel. So, for example, in Texas, a 20-year shingle lasts about 15 years. A 30-year shingle lasts about 20 or 25 years. So let's say your roof is 5 years old. You decide to get solar panels. The solar panels have a functional life, if properly cared for, of about 20 years. Your roof may only have a remaining life of about 15. Ah, herein we have a problem. So, Trump, God, I can't help it, man. He's permeated my brain.
You're learning your ABCs.
My AB Trumps. All right. So what Musk is saying is he wants to develop shingles, tiles, that you can use to re-roof your house when it reaches the end of its, when the roof reaches the end of its functional life. Rather than buying a shingle roof and then installing solar panels, that the tiles for the roof would be the solar panels, which makes a lot of sense because people are, there's always roof replacement going on. I mean, in Houston, the sun beats down mercilessly. I think in my life at this point, I've already probably replaced four roofs in various homes. So, you know, this is a thing, and I think it's really interesting. I don't know if other people have been working on it or not, but, you know, Elon Musk, you know, the guy's like a legend. Okay, apparently, and it might have happened today, a federal court in Texas, a federal district court, has blocked the federal government's guidance on transgender bathrooms, as reported by the Washington Post. In an order filed Sunday, a federal district court in Texas issued an injunction barring the federal government from enforcing the administration's position that federal civil rights laws require that schools allow students to use bathroom facilities that correspond with their professed gender identity. And this position was detailed in a Dear Colleague letter issued by the Education and Justice Departments in May. Again, you can go to thinkwingradio.com. I have links to these. And, of course, the articles themselves have links within them, some of which I have embedded in the blog post. In a 38-page opinion, Judge Reed O'Connor concluded that the plaintiffs had standing to challenge the guidance documents at issue, that their claim was ripe for judicial resolution, and that they had a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. The decision, in yet another case captioned Texas v. United States, will certainly be appealed. The most important part of the decision was the court's conclusion that the DOE and DOJ guidance was invalid because the agencies failed to go through a notice and comment rulemaking before declaring that, for instance, school districts are obligated to accommodate the stated gender identities of students under existing law. So, you know, based on that last part, if there is in fact a comment period that needs to be gone through, it's basically an administrative stall. Let's see. FBI uncovers 14,900 more documents in the Clinton email probe, which is a 50% increase in the 30,000 documents that Clinton had previously turned over. Lawyers for the State Department and the conservative group called the conservative legal group called Judicial Watch are negotiating a plan for the release of the emails in a civil public records lawsuit before U.S. District Judge James E. Bausberg of Washington. Emails. I'm telling you, the Republicans over the last 30, 40 years have probably spent $100 million of mostly taxpayer money trying to get something on the Clintons. So when we talk about if Hillary is elected being a weak president, I think she will be probably one of our most combative presidents. I can't say she'll be as progressive as FDR, but FDR was not a passive guy. He tried to push through a lot of things that didn't make it. And in addition to the stuff we know that did, I think that's going to be more like Hillary. I think she's going to be an extremely combative president because she'll finally have the platform to fight back effectively. I think she probably has some grudges to settle. Okay, just a little bit here. We do have open lines, by the way, 713-526-5738. I don't know if you know this, but Melissa Gilbert from Little House on the Prairie was running for Congress in the 8th Congressional District in Michigan, and she had to withdraw for medical reasons. So the Democratic Party there had to find a replacement for her, and the Republican Party said, oh, no, you can't let her off the ballot because the filing deadline has passed. So it got into a legal tussle, but basically the Democrats can put in a substitute. Too bad. Little House on the Prairie in Congress. That would have been pretty cool. Wells Fargo must pay $4 million to settle charges of illegal student loan practices, as reported in the Los Angeles Times. Wells Fargo has agreed to pay $4 million in fines and rebates over allegations that it charged illegal fees to student loan borrowers. As part of the deal announced Monday, the San Francisco banking giant did not admit or deny wrongdoing, but agreed to pay an additional $3.6 million penalty to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, in addition to $410,000 in refunds to borrowers who paid fees that they should never have been charged. Wells Fargo, through a spokesman, said that all of the CFPB's allegations relate to practices that Wells Fargo changed several years ago, and that affected only a small number of borrowers. I think there was something further down in the article that it had to do, I think, some of it with overdrafts, that banks, when you're running short of funds, instead of going to the small bills to pay. I see we've got it. Greg is online. Okay, give me a minute. Then instead of paying the smaller bills first, they were paying the bigger bills, which tended to go over the balance, and then they get a lot more insufficient funds fees from you, and apparently that's part of what this Wells Fargo thing is related to. And there have been other consent decrees with other banks that have done the same thing, Chase and others, Bank of America. Okay, we still have open lines, and we do have time on the show to get several people on, 713-526-5738. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Remember to go to kpft.org and click on the tip jar. Donate whatever you can, small, large, or medium. Okay, we've got Greg on the line. Greg, you're on the air. How you doing?
Mike, as always. I don't know if you got to see the new Rolling Stones just come out, and they were talking about what kind of president Hillary Clinton would be,
mm-hmm.
and also what kind of party the Democratic Party is now,
yeah.
and how they think she would lead as president. And they brought up some of the facts that basically a lot of these attacks started in the late 80s, early 90s from the New York Times.
Oh, hell, they started when they were in Arkansas. I mean,
in Arkansas.
Yeah.
And what I would always ask my conservative friends who want to go after the Clintons so much, be careful what you wish for, because if you want fairness, let's say you have a Republican president, you'll be some of the same people who will be yelling about how the media is unfair and how they don't cover the president the same way that you would do if it was a liberal or a Democrat. Now, you're the same people who at times want to hide behind the cloak of the Constitution and fairness and the law when it suits your purposes. And yet, when those same issues are turned on you in a way with any kind of modicum of either truth or perspective on it, you guys are usually the first ones to cry foul. And if we're going to talk about a constitution, it has to be good for everybody.
Yeah.
Not just for the people who we agree with. It has to be there for the people that we vehemently disagree with. Even the people that we may vehemently look down upon with some disdain.
That's actually one of the reasons that I've said a number of times that the ACLU should be an organization that conservatives love. They are really constitutional and legal literalists, and they defend the unpopular. And I don't know why. I think it's because conservatives like the Constitution in the places that they agree with it or in the places that work for them, and the other constitutional parts, they get annoyed when people want to enforce them. Do you get that impression?
Yeah, I do. I think at times it depends on who they have to deal with. If it's, because remember, the perfect example would be if you go back 46, 47 years ago, 48 now, a certain president in his 1968 acceptance speech used the term law and order.
Yep, Nixon.
That's your Nixon. Now, how many people, whether you're progressive or not, understand that Richard Nixon and other conservatives have always talked in code, and they're always going to talk in code to certain groups of people to either put fear into them in this us versus them environment, and they must understand, too, they know what they're doing. I mean, why do you think that we've heard all of the stuff about certain people, former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, basically saying that groups like Black Lives Matter are racist?
Yeah, isn't that funny? I mean, it's sad but funny.
It's almost ironic that if it were the other way around and some other group had the guns and the power and they were doing some of the things that have been alleged, I wonder would we be saying the same things? Would those people be saying the same thing?
Well, I think, first of all, and this is my interpretation now, my understanding and impression and thought, you know, when you hear the phrase Black Lives Matter, there is a certain mindset that wants to interpret that as Black Lives Matter more than white lives, which is where the All Lives Matter response comes from. But my interpretation from my readings, from what I have seen on YouTube and news reports, I'm going to say it's my interpretation. If I were to put a long form name to Black Lives Matter, I think it's really shorthand for Black Lives Should Matter as Much as White Lives.
Yep.
That's what they're really saying, because statistically, they do not. That's just a statistical fact. And, you know, statistical facts are something that Republicans and the gun lobby really don't want collected in a national database. That's really one of the sources of their strength, is that there is not a national database for this stuff. And they have done everything they can to obstruct the formation of a national database about gun violence. So like the CDC is not allowed to spend any money on research about gun violence that they can collect from across the United States. But I think anecdotally, There is powerful evidence. I personally have spoken to people of color, particularly black people, African Americans, and there are states in which they will not drive. There are states in which they will not go. And that's because their lives don't matter as much as white lives when the guns start coming out. That's just a simple statistical and historical fact. And it's a mindset. It's a mindset that we think of as regional, but it is not confined to the regions that stereotypically we think of. It's a reality. And we need to somehow fight it. You know, there are old people like me that have stuff ingrained in their brains that you try intellectually to overcome. There are people that have it ingrained that don't try to overcome it intellectually. And then you have people like the young urban generation, like my stepdaughter, who don't even see race. They just don't think about it in a lot of urban environments. So there's hope.
Yep.
But, you know, we still have stuff to overcome.
We still do. And I would actually ask people to read the current issue of Time magazine that just came out, where they talk about hatred on the internet. And it's an interesting piece. And they also mentioned, like, different people and different names that certain people use on the net when they're trying to troll different ethnic groups or different writers because of the views that they hold.
You know, Vice, which has become a really useful news source, I'm just looking for the story. Vice had three people take a road trip across the United States. Where is my article? I can't locate it. It's on one of my notes. Anyway, they had an article about an African-American, a Muslim, and a Latino, or a Latina, who actually was Puerto Rican, not Mexican descent. So she was born a U.S. citizen, as all Puerto Ricans are. And they took this road trip across the United States to locations specified by the Vice editorial staff, or the editor that was sort of running the story. And again, I have a link to this. Jeez, I wish I could find the title. Amazing.
Did you go to sleep in there?
No, I'm making noises so people know I'm on the air. And I'm just looking for the title of this thing. I don't know why I don't have it. All right, anyway, it's about what he calls, I think, to paraphrase, his terrifying cross-country trip across the United States. The title is a little bit more inflammatory than the story. The story, of course, talks about places where he met racism, but he also had some positive experiences. But, you know, it points to, we're not hopeless as a nation in terms of race, but there's still a lot of hard feeling. You know, one of the things that I'm going to point to, it just goes to show how long intergenerational memory is. When we talk about the Iran base thing that I mentioned earlier, apparently there was a treaty that was signed like 150 years ago between Iran and the Russian Empire that ceded a large portion of the Caucasus to Russia. And they still, it's like 150 years ago, and they still hold a grudge. So not so different from our South, our old South.
Mm-hmm.
Grudges are intergenerational. In the Balkans, you know, they've got grudges going back 1,000 years. And really, that's the thing we have to somehow figure out how to fight. How do you fight grudges that are passed down from generation to generation? It's something we have not succeeded at till this point. And I think that sort of becomes the central question. How do we fight that? Any ideas? Any thoughts?
I think one of the things you have to do is say to people, how did this start? You know, and how do you hand it down from one generation to a succeeding generation? To get them to understand that you can't refight that battle. That battle's over and done with. You have to try to deal with what you have to concern yourself with at the present.
Is this a job for schools to try to counter this intergenerational message that's handed down, that we have some even to get? Do schools, I mean, are schools the place where that has to be counter-argued?
Yeah, I think schools have to be the place. I think you have to have people who can put a thing in context for folks, even in a modern society like ours, to say, look, this is why this happened. You can't refight a battle. You can't re-litigate an argument. And you have to tell people that even when you fight, what do you win, ultimately? What have you gained?
You know, there's a great line in the movie The Time Machine, the 1960 version, which is the classic. I don't know why they bothered making a remake. And there are a lot of great moments in that movie, and one of them is when the time traveler is explaining to Weena that about the all clear, and he says, the people that are telling us this story, because they have the rings, the people that are telling this story are dead. The people that slaughtered them are dead. And that relates to so much of human history. The people that killed them are dead. The people that they killed are dead. And it's time, 100, 500, 1,000 years later, to try to move on. Because otherwise these vendettas are literally endless. They'll take us to the end of human time. But, oh, really? Normally we go to 57. Okay. I got 1 minute. I'm going to let you go because apparently right. I'm being cut short.
Okay.
So thank you for calling, Greg, and I'll do a sign-off.
All right.
All right. You take care. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Bob Gartner has been on engineering. Thank you, Bob. Remember, you can go to kpft.org, go to the tip jar, make a contribution, help support the station, and you can see the articles that I've been referring to at thinkwingradio.com by clicking on today's show post. My quote that I decided to go with today is often attributed to Mark Twain, but actually he may have been paraphrasing Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And the quote is that a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. In the age of the internet and the 24-hour news cycle, that is truer now than it was when he said it. Have a great week. I'll speak to you next Monday. Take care.
KPFT's effort to elect a new board of directors is underway, and we've begun broadcasting statements by candidates for seats to that board. Over the election period, candidates may make remarks about the station and its parent organization. Please note these opinions may not reflect the position of Pacifica or KPFT. You are encouraged to research claims and to cast an informed vote. You can visit Pacifica's election website for complete candidate statements. KPFT needs your support. Make a secure donation anytime at kpft.org. Thank you for listening. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
If you've heard a KPFT pledge drive before, you've probably heard this line 1,000 times.
Our volunteers are here to take your call.
But volunteering at KPFT is more than pledge drives. It's the folks who help pack your thank you gifts.
Or the people who spend a Saturday painting walls, or helping at a booth, or even distributing KPFT flyers around town.
You may hear a lot about volunteers during our pledge drives, but helping out at KPFT is an around-the-clock endeavor.
Why wait for a pledge drive when you can volunteer today?
Call 713-526-4000 to learn more about volunteering at KPFT, or visit kpft.org to download a volunteer application to indicate your interest.
Talk with one of our great staffers to find out how you can help.
Again, that's 713-526-4000 to learn more about volunteering at KPFT.
Or visit kpft.org to download a volunteer application to indicate your interests.
This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
KPFT Houston.